From the Passover Haggadah to the Mishnah and Back, An Introduction to Rabbinic Literature with Rabbi Reuven Cohn, Part 3. This recording is copyright by Reuven Cohn and released under the Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivative Works 3.0 license. For more information, including printed material to follow along with the class, go to www.reuvencohn.com. That's www.reuvencohn.com.
Okay, so for me, there were a couple of magic moments yesterday. One of them was when one of you said, the four questions has an Eastern European aura about it. Right? And we all sat on that, and that sounded, it actually sounded reasonable. And I had mentioned earlier that there are definitely parts of the Seder that are relatively recent. Right? I think I had mentioned that the Chagadya joined the Seder probably in about 1500, no earlier. Okay. So it seemed perfectly reasonable to think of those four questions as a late addition. Okay. Then, what did we do next? We opened the Mishnah. Okay. And what is the Mishnah? It is a composite, a multiple generation book. It is a book composed by five generations of rabbis, starting with the destruction of the temple. And this book is an ordering and or a reordering of all of Jewish law. Okay? Jewish law, halacha. Okay. So, and this book goes back to the year 200, we open up the Mishnah, chapter 10 of Psachim, and we find what basically reads like a Haggadah. And the chapter is divided, does anyone remember how many paragraphs it was?
Nine.
It was all of nine paragraphs. And it looked like a large part of paragraph 4 was the four questions. In other words, those have been around for a long time. Now, so let's go back to, we're looking at chapter 10, Mishnah 1. What did Mishnah 1 do for us?
Told us when the Seder was supposed to start, and it introduced the idea that even those who don't have funds to pay for a Seder are entitled to have one.
Yeah, okay. Now, you just said, it tells us when the Seder is supposed to start. Does it say, you better show up by 6 p.m.? What's its style?
Mincha time and when it gets dark.
Yeah. In the late afternoon, stop
eating.
Stop eating. That's what alerts us to something coming up. Stop eating until
it's dark.
It's dark. So that's the way we are informed that darkness brings to us eating time. Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, and what are we told about that meal that's going to happen? We know about a meal from the Bible, from the Torah. The Torah's meal centers around Paschal Lamb. Mm-hmm. Is there anything else to the evening other than the Paschal Lamb?
There are four cups of wine.
In the Torah?
No.
There actually is, in Exodus 12, there's something about eat things in a hurry.
Yeah.
But the rabbis took that to be only in that primeval evening, but not thereafter. So all that's left from the Torah and from the rest of the Bible is, if you have something that you want to call a Seder, it consists of eating the Paschal Lamb. Now, is that a big deal, having a Paschal Lamb?
There's some unusual parts. Eating at night can't be left after the morning. Unusual things.
Okay. So you can't leave it. You have to finish it. What does it mean to say that there's a Paschal Lamb you have to eat? Are we talking about going to the butchery?
Does it have to do with the sacrifice?
Yeah. So this is a sacrifice. So there's a whole sacrificial system. Every morning, year in, day in, day out, there is an offering on behalf of the entire people. Every afternoon, there's one. These are called Korban Tamid. Okay? And the rabbis remember the morning and afternoon prayer services as being a replacement for that. Okay, now, then if you sinned, you might bring an offering. Okay, who eats these animals? These sacrifices? Who eats them?
The priest.
Would that be the priest?
Okay, so there are some sacrifices which are in Hebrew called Olah, in English, Holocaust, which are eaten by God. And how does God do that?
We burn it.
Yes, they are consumed by the fire. They are consumed by the fire. Okay? And there are lots of them which every sacrifice, the blood and the fat that encases the organs are treated specially. Those are for God. But for the most part, sacrifices are eaten by the priests. Okay? That's how they support their families. They're eaten in a state of purity. Okay. The Passover sacrifice is highly unusual. Well, if you're coming to Jerusalem on a pilgrimage holiday, you probably would bring peace offerings, shlamim. And those peace offerings will provide meat for your family. Okay? But the Paschal Lamb is a unique sacrifice. It's taken outside of temple prep. It is slaughtered up on the temple mount. Okay? Then there is blood offered on the altar. Then the carcass is taken by the family representative to wherever you found place in Jerusalem. And what do you do next? You roast it whole. These are all requirements. You roast it whole over the fire. And then your family eats it. Now, are they going to, is this going to mean something to them?
Sure.
Ah, you've come up to Jerusalem. You've come up to Jerusalem. The lamb was chosen. It had to be just right, no blemishes. It was brought up to the temple on the eve of Passover. There's this whole ritual with the blood. It's all very deliberative. It is meant to mark the original Passover Eve and the families eating it. That was what we today might call the Passover Seder. Now, did that involve telling the Passover story as well? See, what we're just doing now, we took a walk down memory lane, except for it's a memory lane where none of us ever were. And we're trying to think of the Passover Seder in Second Temple times? Did they tell the story as we do? You're thinking. The good news is there is no way anyone can tell you that you are wrong in what you said, because the videotapes, they do exist, but it's old technology and no one can play them.
I would say yes. I would say there's some link between the story of Moses who and some of the sects that sort of came out of
okay.
Moses.
So you're voting yes. In the year 68, when we went up to Jerusalem and we did the sacrifice, we roasted it on outside our door. We ate it together, but we also told the story. That's your vote.
I don't think it's right, but I'm voting for it.
Okay. You know, this explains how that guy got elected president. I'm sure most people said it's not right, but I'm voting for him. Yeah? No, I know
because
what you mean.
I know what you mean. Reasoning from the other way about why they would need to create the story afterward.
Yes.
And I'm imagining pageantry, you know, like a stage and it being reenacted on a stage for the children, for everyone, because this is like a really dramatic event. All these families are gathered around, and it raises it to a level, it's illustrative to the children.
Okay. A moment ago I said no one can say you're wrong.
And I'm wrong.
You're not wrong. No. But I would say what was more likely were that people gathered in small family groups. Okay? You had your lamb, and you had your small family group. So you're imagining a number of groups together with a stage. So you can reimagine, but with a group of 10 people around a lamb. Yeah.
That's a family. But since they came up to the Temple Mount, because the temple was there in 68.
Yeah.
Why isn't it possible that, you know, there'd be a lot of pageantry on top of the man? You know, because we do have, you know, readings where there are all the people at the bottom of the mountain.
So the Temple Mount was not like the transit system in Manhattan. It was like the transit system in Boston. Temple Mount closed down for the night. Okay? There wasn't much activity. And so chapter 5 of Tractate Pesachim has a description of what went on the Temple Mount. It was in the afternoon that your representative took your lamb. There might be 10 people eating the lamb, but only one person would go up there. So that was indeed pageantry. But it was late afternoon pageantry. And in fact, people then left the Temple Mount, and all of Jerusalem was considered sufficiently sacred that you could take your Paschal lamb, which was sacred food, to where you were. Okay.
But at what point, or where do we learn that there was an appointed time for this? In other words, we know the 15th of Nisan, we have our Pesach Seder. With all of this happening, was everybody congregating a real pilgrimage time at the same time? Because if that was the case, it would seem to me that people would look around and wonder, what's the big event that we all know to be here now, and would perhaps tell their what joins them together.
So
I'm voting with her.
Yeah. So, I'm going to paraphrase what you said. My mind tells me that it might be that there was no telling of the story in the old days. But my heart tells me there had to be. Is that an okay paraphrase of what you were saying?
That would be close, but I'd also connect some dots knowing a little bit about, you know, the sex in Jerusalem and the sex outside of Jerusalem, and some were more akin to Aaron and some followed Moses. So there's some, and that could be way off, but there's some connection to this story.
By the year 68, let's say 65, so it's not so close. By the year, the notion Moses, Aaron,
yeah,
those have receded into the distance,
okay,
with practically no memory of them.
Okay.
Now,
okay,
let's talk about ritual. Why is ritual powerful? Why do people even bother with ritual?
Because it binds us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay.
It binds us to our parents and our previous generations and our kids,
yeah,
and it gives us something. It gives us a framework to hold on to.
So, if you have a chance to read anything written by Jacob Milgram about the Book of Leviticus, this is a conservative rabbi and Torah scholar who loves Leviticus. And he talks about, in one of his commentaries on Leviticus, he writes that he was teaching at a Protestant seminary. It was a great experience. He taught there the first year, whatever he taught. The second year, they say, what do you want to teach this year? And he says, Leviticus. And the head of the divinity school had a fit. No, we don't do Leviticus. That's a waste of time. And here was, so Milgram tells this story to describe what was a very common attitude, not among just about everybody. America, in the middle of the last century, ritual was not in style. Okay? Who needs ritual?
Everyone.
No.
In the middle of the last century, who needs ritual? Who needs ritual?
The immigrants.
Hmm? Primitive peoples.
Right.
Primitive peoples need ritual. We are sophisticated. We don't need ritual. Okay? Now, there has been a dramatic shift in all segments of society, and people have come to recognize that ritual is something that, as you said, that we need. But what does ritual do for you?
Well, it gives you an identity.
Okay. So, Mary Douglas, who is a very interesting author to read, studied these so-called primitive societies in order to come to an understanding of ritual. And she said that a society encodes its values in its rituals. And so, what do you get? What's your value? What's your value? Give me a value.
Providing for the poor.
Providing for the poor. So you can say it, or you can do something which reinforces it. So there's a, in the mid-20th century, what they didn't like about ritual was, but you're not thinking. Now, you look at it just a little differently. You know what's nice about ritual?
You
don't have to think. It's like certain drives that you take when you drive to work. Yeah, autopilot. Autopilot is probably kind of a negative way to put it. Okay, so if you think about the great ritual that was the Paschal Lamb, I think we don't have anything as heavily ritualized as that was. It was ritual. You didn't have to think. The doing had so much encoded in it. And therefore, it is entirely likely that when they did the Passover Seder in Second Temple times,
they didn't have to talk about it.
They didn't. Maybe they did, but they didn't feel they had to. Now, with that,
you know what that's like? That's like the Seders that I grew up with.
my father and his brother, they just did it. There was never any discussion. They just went right through it.
But did that work?
Yeah, because it was always done that way. And, you know, I'd never saw it done some other way, and that's the way it was just done. That was the Seder.
Okay. So, interesting. So now, if we think of those rabbis in the year 70 and their five-generation project, is Passover something important? You bet. What's your problem now with the temple gone?
You've lost the structure.
Lost the structure.
To make it meaningful.
You've lost
the ritual. The ritual.
Yeah, you've had the stuffing knocked out of you. Now, let's go back to what you said earlier. Even if we insist that in Second Temple, they did tell the story. So they told the story, but what was the main event?
The
Paschal Lamb, by its nature, had to be the main event. And with the destruction of the temple, these guys in chapter 10, they've got a big problem. And what do they come up with?
A substitution. Okay. Substitute for the Paschal Lamb.
Okay, so now, and how do we... Yeah, the Seder has to serve as a substitute for the Paschal Lamb. Now, let's take a little side trip. A little side trip to one of the groups within Christianity. This is a group, a fervent group, who's having the same problem as everyone else on Passover with what do we do about the loss of the Paschal Lamb, and what do they come up with?
Easter. Jesus.
Yes, Jesus is
the Paschal Lamb.
The Lamb of God. The Lamb of God. Now, Easter is ultimate Christianity. You think Easter, it's Christian, it's not Jewish. Yet when you look at it closely, it's almost the same. It's a response to the same vacuum, exactly. Mm-hmm. So it's just fascinating. Now, what do they call Easter in Hebrew? Anyone know? Mm-hmm. Actually, you probably all know. Almost. So take the word, what language were they talking in? What language were the people speaking?
Aramaic.
Aramaic. How do we know? We know that thanks to Mel Gibson. So the word in Hebrew is Pesach. Many Aramaic words are very similar to Hebrew with an aleph stuck on at the end. So Pesach in Aramaic is... How can you give me the Aramaic of Pesach?
Pascha.
Pascha.
Like Pascha.
Pascha. And Pascha in Hebrew is the word for Easter.
Oh, nice.
And so let's try Pascha. How do you say Easter in French? Those of us who had to take French.
Pâques.
Pâques. P-A-Q-U. Accent circumflex, which is replacement for an S. So Pâques in French comes from Aramaic Pascha. So it is something very profound to see how the two traditions have this common affinity. Okay, now. So, what about we saw Mishnah 1 that put the poor in our minds, right? We have to have them as our focus. Now, then we saw that there is a resonance of Mishnah 1 in the Haggadah itself. Do you remember where Mishnah 1, what had Mishnah 1 said? He is not to have less than 4 cups of wine, even if he must take it from the Tamhoi. And before that, Mishnah 1 said, a person, even the poorest of Israel, is not to eat until he sits down formally. The poorest of Israel. Okay. So, yes. So, in the Magid, in the telling of the story, in a way, the four questions kick off the telling of the story. But before the four questions, what do we have? Halach ma'anya. This is the bread of affliction. Or, let's try a different translation. Halach ma'anya. The bread of
the poor.
Okay, so we talk about a central symbol of the day, the matzah. And do we have matzah on our mind? What have we done a second earlier?
Yachatz,
which is we've just broken a matzah. And now we say, this matzah, although it cost me $3 a box, is... it is bread of poor people. Okay? And now that I'm talking about poor people, let me say something else about poor people. Let whoever is hungry come in and eat. Let whoever is needy come and do Pesach. Now, that is an invitation, but is it really the invitation? We're sitting down at the table. We've already done some stuff. We've done some kiddush. We've dipped the karpas. We've broken the middle matzah. Is this now the time that we're inviting the poor?
It's a little late.
Yeah. So this is really a symbolic invitation, which is putting on the agenda the value, it has to be stated at this point, but the real point of it is you've acted on it earlier. So this is a symbolic invitation. Okay, now.
Is it possible that there were people in the neighborhood who waited outside for people to say this and then invite them inside, because there were probably many, many poor people who, knew that this was a possibility, and maybe the host, the father, would go to the door, as he would say that, to invite anyone who's hanging out.
It's possible. Yeah?
It seems reasonable that your explanation of having someone already there, and this is inserted, is in some sense the formal acknowledgement of the fact that someone's there. It's like when you give your introductions from the dais before you give your speech.
Of course, you know, we can get into a little trouble here. And right to my left, this is our poor person. See the shabby clothing? Yes. Now, let's go back to the Mishnah. And what comes next? In the Mishnah, after... how had Mishnah 1 ended? Which of the props of the evening did Mishnah 1 mention?
Wine.
The wine, in terms of it being 4 cups of wine. Now, and then let's look at the start of Mishnah 2. Can someone read the first line of Mishnah 2?
They poured for him the first cup.
Hebrew, mazgulo kos rishon. Then Mishnah 4, first line.
They poured for him the second cup.
Okay. And then, where do you find the rest of them?
Mishnah 7.
They poured for him the third cup. And a moment later,
the fourth,
the fourth
cup.
So the four cups of wine give structure to the evening. Each cup is accompanies an element of the evening. The first cup accompanies
beginning of the Seder.
The Kiddush, sanctification. What's the second cup for?
Dinner.
The four questions.
It's just before the four questions, meaning the story. So you recite the story, and at the end of the recital of the story, you drink cup number two. Okay, then you eat your meal. Grace after meals is cup, you say it, and then cup number three. And then you have Hallel, singing God's praises, and then with cup number four. Now, is the notion of Kiddush over wine, is that in the Bible? See, nowadays with Google, you can't just give an answer and know that who's going to know. There is something about wine in sacred and sacredness. There were some wine libations in the temple that accompanied sacrifices. But I would say that when the temple is destroyed, one of the ways to connect to the old days was to create something new around wine. Wine had some association with the temple, and so if we see these four cups of wine organizing our evening, we are in the process, we are finding something new to be sacred instead of whatever went on in the temple. Okay, so Mishnah 2 was the first cup of wine. Now, Mishnah 3 was what?
The symbols of food.
The symbols of food. So I'd like to hold Mishnah 3 in abeyance to look at Mishnah 4. So let's read Mishnah 4 together. With Mishnah 4, we're going to see what they had to say in the year 200 about how to tell the story. And based on our discussion earlier, how to tell the story may itself have been a post-temple innovation to fill the terrible gap. Okay? So let's read. Can we continue around? We'll go this way.
They poured for him the second cup, and here the son asked his father.
Once again with feeling.
They poured for him the second cup, and here the son asked his father.
Oh, how are we doing? And here, V'chan habein sho'el aviv. Any comments so far? Any comments from anybody so far? No? So let's go on. Huh?
Do you want us to comment on the sexism of it, or what?
If you like.
And if the son does not have understanding, his father teaches him.
Okay. Any comments now?
Well, it's already been set up that this is an educational opportunity.
What does "it's already been set up" mean?
Well, we have here a son asking a father.
So the Mishnah in the year 200.
Yes.
That's what you mean by already?
Yes, that's what I mean by already.
Okay.
Has set up that one of the purposes of this is that we are teaching.
Well, it's almost beyond that, because I'm thinking to myself, what if the son doesn't ask? So somehow there's a...
But that's...
It says that.
See, I actually see this as being the instruction. I'm reading a script here.
Uh-huh.
If the sun would normally... If okay, we take it as the sun spontaneously asking questions, look at all the stuff we talked about in Mishnah 3, all this unusual stuff. We usually think in terms of Seder equals unusual things. A child will ask questions. However, we're getting to this point here. This sounds like a stage direction to me.
Okay, so here's something interesting. We are reading this based on what we know about today's Haggadah. The trick is to read it putting aside today's Haggadah. Okay? So here it says, and here the son asks his father. What does he ask? What does he ask?
He asks how is tonight different from other nights.
Okay, that's a possibility. And what happens, and it tells you right away, if the son doesn't have understanding, what should the father teach him?
Why this night is different from other nights.
Thank you.
Okay. I need you to be more specific.
Why we eat matzah, why we eat maror, why we...
Okay.
Sit reclining.
Why we...
No, that one's not there.
But they eat roasted.
Okay.
That's good.
No, so, here the son asks his father... The four questions. If the son is not able to do so, what should the father teach him? The questions or the answers?
How to ask.
How to ask.
Yeah. How to be interested.
How to ask. So that is a very legitimate reading of this. Here the son asks. If the son cannot ask, the father teaches him. And then what follows?
The questions.
So what is the function of these standard questions?
To pull the children into the...
What is the function of these standard questions in this Mishnah?
To instruct the father.
Interesting. So let me give you a possible reading. Here the son asks his father anything that's on his mind. Open mic. But can every kid do that? No. So if the kid cannot ask, what is the father to teach him?
To ask questions.
Which questions?
How is this night different from all other nights?
So according to this reading... The four questions, the beloved four questions, are for whom?
For the father to teach the son to ask the questions.
To teach which son?
The one that can't ask.
The one that can't ask. So the beloved four questions are a lowest common denominator, boilerplate questions, and you actually said it earlier, that the father can pull out of his pocket to teach the kid, to initiate the kid into a culture of questioning. Now, what about the other kids?
By other kids, you mean those who already know how to ask questions?
Yes.
Well,
what's the Mishnah say?
He alludes to other kids according to the understanding of the son. So there may be someone that does understand.
Read line two.
Oh, line two.
And then line three. And line two, three, and four.
And here the son asks his father, and if the son does not have understanding, his father teaches him.
Okay, and his father teaches him what? The boilerplate.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so... How many questionings are happening at the Seder, at the Mishnah Seder?
Unlimited number.
Yeah. So as many kids as are around the table, what is the expectation?
That they're all going to ask questions.
They're all going to ask questions. Open mic. Ask your questions. And the one who can't?
We'll teach him to
ask. Just tell him.
It's not just tell him. Teach him.
To ask questions.
Or teach him the basic questions. Okay, do we do this today? Do we follow this Mishnah? Mm-hmm. What has happened?
I think we do. We more have a performance of the child.
And okay. It's a boy.
Well, what do we do? Who asks at this point?
The youngest.
The youngest? Does anyone else ask anything?
Yes. And I say that everyone asks questions.
Oh, we're talking about the four questions.
And they may ask them related to this, so they're
Right,
but
I mean,
obviously, I answered the wrong question. I did it wrong.
I'm answering my own question.
Let's say you invited 20 people to your Seder, you're the host, and you say, is your kid prepared to ask the four questions of the family that has the youngest kid?
Right.
I mean, isn't that the thing you ask them
right.
more you invite
right.
them or when right. you invite them?
Right.
So
and
you
if they're
said
not,
at your
them,
Seder, everyone asks. When do they ask?
People are invited to interrupt the whole meal. And
is that what this mission is talking about?
Well, I'm not sure.
You have to read it.
I would say yes, because if they're teaching, if the father is saying teach this, he's not teaching it just for the moment. He's teaching a way of living, a way of thinking, a way of looking at the world, a way of asking as opposed to accepting.
I think where it says, and here, there's a very specific order already implied here. Right here is where you ask this question about the basic symbols that we're dealing with. Here,
yes.
After the cup is poured.
Okay.
Which doesn't, I don't know in terms of what happens in terms of asking the questions the rest of the night, but these are things that
right.
definitely have
right.
to get covered here.
So you are talking about a culture of questioning. Throughout the night, questions are welcome from everybody. This is talking about at the start of the evening, at a certain point in time, children are here, the child asks. What is the child to ask at this point? It doesn't say. But then it says, woo, if the child cannot,
These are the questions.
So the four questions in this reading of the Mishnah are for whom? The one who can't ask his own questions. How has that evolved over time? How has that evolved?
Do we do it this way? It's the only questions that are asked.
Right. So what has fallen away? Something has fallen away.
Freewheeling inquiry.
Yes.
Has fallen
yes.
Away.
The Mishnah seemed to have been calling for freewheeling inquiry by all the kids, and that has dropped out, and all that's left for us is the routine question by
the youngest.
Why has that fallen out?
Maybe because there aren't people who could answer anything else.
Right.
Interesting. As much as we talk about, you said freewheeling inquiry. We love freewheeling inquiry. We think we love freewheeling inquiry, but not because if there's freewheeling inquiry, what does that require?
Knowledge.
Freewheeling
responses.
Response. So there's a constant struggle. There's a constant struggle when you're involved with ritual with, are you just going to be content with the ritual piece or are you going to be
looking for meaning?
Now, your comment is a very telling one. If you start off the evening, even if you started off with a ritualized question by the youngest, what is the message behind that ritual?
Children should ask questions.
Yeah. First of all, the children are important. Mm-hmm. And second of all, the questions are important. And then that can be acted out in all sorts of ways. But what I was interested here is seeing how the language of the Mishnah supports something different than actually happened over time. That the non-ritualized part dropped out of our consciousness. Okay, now let's read the four questions. Yeah?
Cool. Yeah. On this night, for on all nights we eat chametz and matzah, this night all is matzah.
Yeah, so that's one question. How are we doing so far? That's more. Okay, next. Yeah, next person.
For on all nights we eat other vegetables, this night maror.
So far so good? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
For on all nights we eat meat roasted, stewed, or boiled, this night all is roasted.
What happened to that question?
Got lost.
It got lost.
Yeah, General Electric.
General Electric.
Okay, I have my own paraphrase of this question. First of all, what does it mean? On all other nights, we eat meat roasted. Tonight, all is roasted.
To remind you of the Paschal Lamb, I guess.
Okay. The Paschal Lamb, very specifically, had to be
roasted.
So some scholars think that this is a question
to tie back to the temple.
This is so ancient. This is a question that was actually asked when there was a temple.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. And now other scholars say, no. Temple times, they didn't do this talking part. They just did the eating part. But this was, after the temple was destroyed, there's still this living memory of the roasting, and perhaps they served roasted lamb at the table, but then with the passage of time, this just got to be, no one knew what they were talking about anymore. It just receded, so the question dropped out. Okay, that's fine. And in order to keep four questions, what was added?
Reclining.
And the standard interpretation you hear is reclining used to be the way you would have any formal meal. It wasn't just a Passover thing. Okay, fine. Now, we have one more question. No. I have to tell you how I translate the roasting question. This is for Jewish cooking. For on all other nights, we eat meat over roasted, over stewed, and over boiled. You cook it till you're sure it's dead, the Eastern European way. Okay.
Do you know what we grew up? Our seders, we never had roasted meat the first night. There was some tradition in our house.
Yes.
That you
not to. Yes.
Not to replicate.
Yes.
The pace of
this
certainly
is
not lamb.
Oh.
Certainly
yes.
Not roast. And
yeah. This is a very strong tradition among Ashkenazic Jews that you are not to have, certainly not lamb and nothing roasted, because we don't have the temple. Sephardic Jews will have roasted lamb. One more indication, Sephardic Jews know how to live. But now, I still recall, you said, so what did you have? You had boiled chicken. So we used to have boiled chicken. And then I remember one year, my mother sitting at the table and saying, you know, as long as it's not roasted, there are lots of other ways to make chicken. I don't have to make it boiled like this just because my mother did. So that was the end of the boiled, and I missed it.
So she was the rebellious generation.
She got old and told us.
And this is being recorded.
Is it also possible that the reason we went from this business of the roasting the lamb was poverty? That they used to have boiled or stewed or whatever.
That's
meat.
Very interesting. Very, very interesting. That, yes. Because there clearly were two different, you always read two different pressures. Do Do you try to emulate the way it was in the good old days, or do you try to make sure you realize it's not like in the good old days? And you're saying there's a third factor. Mm-hmm. Emulating the good old days was may have been too expensive.
But,
yeah.
But we're going further. If this is taken as being halakha, then in fact, by eating the boiled chicken, we are actually going against what's written in the Mishnah. It's not a question of just tradition dropped the formula, but if in fact the formula was law at one time, the law changed itself.
Laws change. Don't tell Antonin Scalia, though.
But it just says meat. It just says basar. And
right.
Could basar be meat of a bird?
Okay.
Well, no.
That's right. Chicken wasn't considered.
It was flesh. Basar.
But chicken wasn't considered flesh until Pasa after this time.
Yeah. Practically. Oh, I don't know when chicken was made flesh. It's too bad.
but we go back to the flanken, which also is a traditional item. So we're
just to play,
which is really poor man's meat.
Just to play devil's advocate here for a moment, I think you could actually interpret this paragraph, this Mishnah, as not an invitation to free will and inquiry, but as, in fact, just a series of ritual questions that you're supposed to go through. And all you need to do...
So how do you read it? Yeah.
All you need to do to make that adjustment is to tweak the punctuation in the first four lines a little bit.
Yeah.
And here the son asks his father, parentheses, and if the son does not have understanding, close parentheses, his father teaches him, colon.
Yes. Excellent. Mm-hmm. Excellent. Those are the two possible readings of the Mishnah. Okay. Now, and why didn't the Mishnah have parentheses? They hadn't been invented yet. Mishnah essentially does not have punctuation because punctuation is a more recent. So, and punctuation itself, when modern editions put in punctuation, punctuation is, as you have exactly illustrated, punctuation is a commentary. Now, but in your way of reading it, and here the son asks, parentheses, and if not, the father teaches him, what does the son ask? The four questions. So which son should do that? The four questions. The way you're reading it, it sounds like every child at the table should do what?
Ask the questions.
Ask the four questions. Right. Ask the ritual questions. Okay? So, in fact, that's what we do in our family. And I can tell you that it's very nice. It's very nice custom. It's safe. It's comfortable. As we got older, so my mother would always say them in Hebrew and then in Yiddish, and she would always say, Meisha ichvel defregen defirkashes. And when she was all through, she would say, Meisha give me an enfer afalafirkashes. And over the years, some of us would say it in Yiddish and some of us wouldn't. Some of us would bring home an Israeli tune from school, some then a different tune. It was an opportunity for a little bit of individuality. So, but as you said last time, you're worrying about making the Seder too long. You don't want to add those extra 30 seconds.
And would they ask in your Seder or in this idea, would one ask it of their own particular elder, of their own particular parent? Or what?
So this is a good question.
The reason I ask it is because I was at a Seder where of a dear friend of mine who's my age, whose father is still alive and is a great learned man, and he literally got up from his seat next to his wife and six married children and went and sat next to his father on the floor and asked his father the question.
Wow.
And it was the most dramatic thing I'd ever experienced.
Okay, cool.
And it was in Dutch.
And did the father answer?
Yes. His father gave some answer, then later on it was but it was quite a dramatic event.
We need to look at the fourth question. Whoops. Did we? What happened?
Haven't done it yet.
The fourth question, yes. Yeah. Who's next?
For an all nights, we dip one time, this night two times.
So how are we doing? Is this good?
Mm-hmm.
No, it isn't.
Well, you're going for the difference between in anu ba'pilim afilu pam echad in the modern Haggadah, not even one time.
Yeah. So what's happening? So in the Mishnah, the dipping question is a little different. Mm-hmm. What is our dipping question?
Not once. Even.
Afilu pam echad, not even.
All other nights.
We don't dip at all.
Tonight we dip twice. And what are the two dips tonight?
Once versus twice.
What are the two dips?
The salt water and the charoset.
Could you tell me? You just told me what you're dipping in.
So what are you asking? The karpas.
The karpas, the vegetable into salt water.
And the maror.
Into charoset. And as I said, my mother adds the explanation here. Ein mal ala necht von agansior tunken mir nicht ein afilu, well Hebrew, ein mal. Aber die nacht von Pesach tunken mir ein zweimal. Ein mal a kartoffel in Salzwasser, potato. Ein mal maror in charoset. Now, what is the symbolism of the kartoffel in the Salzwasser? The potato in the salt water. Or the parsley in the salt water? Petrushka.
Parsley. You went to Sunday school?
Yeah. Yep.
Dipping in the tears of the...
Salt water symbolizes the tears. And the parsley?
Spring.
The rebirth of spring.
Right.
And potato... If you try hard enough, you can find green ones.
the poor people's.
Yeah. Oh, yes. Now, what does the Mishnah's version, the version from the year 200, says what?
We dip one time.
All other nights we dip once. Tonight we dip twice. So what is the dip? So if tonight we have the parsley dip and the maror dip, all other nights, which of those two do we have all other nights?
I think it's the dipping in the salt water. Life was bitter. The temple had been destroyed.
No, in the regular time, you would flavor your food. No?
Okay. But I'm asking a question.
What's the question?
What's the dip?
If we say we have two dips, the parsley and the...
salt water.
And the parsley and the maror. And we're now told, all other nights we have one of those. Tonight we add a second. Is there any question which is the one that we have all other nights?
Not maror.
Not maror. Maror is...
The vegetable we only eat tonight.
Yeah, maror is the bitterness of the slavery. Okay, so what's that saying about karpas?
They always ate it with salt. I don't know.
Say it just a little differently.
They always dipped
potatoes in salt water.
Or vegetables.
Okay, so this Mishnah opens us up to a fascinating piece of history. What we call karpas, which we make a big deal out of, what you call the Sunday school version, the tears, the this, the that, what we call karpas, what is it really? It's something that they used to eat
All the time.
Pretty regular.
All the time. What would you call it? You wouldn't call it carpus because you don't speak that language usually. What would you call this thing that you have at the... Well, I'll give you a hint.
Vegetable?
I'll give you a hint. Instead of calling it salt water, call it Paul Newman salt water.
Dressing.
Dressing. So carpus originally was...
Salad.
Now, the Jewish people, and in the time of the Mishnah, where are they living?
Still in Israel.
In the Galilee. Okay. Lots of vegetables there. They every night, night in, night out, they start their meal with their karpas and their salt water, and they dip it. They do. Do they do it Passover also?
Yes.
Why do they do it Passover?
Because
salad's good for you all the time. Then they move to a place with less vegetables, Babylonia or Poland. And so what happens? What happens? The first Seder in Babylonia and Poland.
It's not spring yet.
So, but what happens when you start off your meal?
You start off the old way.
You do it the old way. You do it the way we used to do it. And what do you start saying about it after a while? What do you start saying about the Paul Newman salt water?
It gets old after a while.
It's a symbol.
When you transform something prosaic into a ritual, the general feelings of the evening get transmitted to that new ritual. And that new ritual is also supporting what's going on. Everybody here is part of that same process. There are certain things, I'm sure you can think of something in your family that has become your family's Passover ritual that means Passover for you. I'll give you mine. So my parents had a set of milchik dishes and fleishik dishes, and then they had the Passover dishes, milchik and fleishik. Now the Passover dishes you use so infrequently. So by the time I was a kid, the regular dishes had been replaced many times, but the Passover dishes were still the original set they bought when they came to America. Okay? And they come out year after year, and after a while they start developing cracks, but you don't replace them because you just use them. So for me, those cracks in the plates, when I would see those cracks, and my mother has now given me those dishes. When I see those cracks in the plates, that's Passover for me. Okay? So what do you have like that?
My mother had the very best dishes, and she saved them for Passover with silver. She only had silver. She didn't have silver during the year. And at Passover, we had the best stuff, and we could hardly wait to polish that silver and to eat on those special dishes. Rosenthal china.
Yeah. Once a year.
One week a year, and we just loved it. Wow. And my sister got them.
Yeah, but she took care of her the last 10 years.
She did. That's right. I was happy. She should have gotten them. I wouldn't have.
I have to tell you that we've been doing Pesach at Maury's mother's for the past 40 years, however many years, and we couldn't really do it in Pittsburgh this year, so we had to move the whole Seder to Cleveland, and she was very, very upset about it, because it wasn't going to be her Seder until, she was convinced that as long as she was there, it was going to be her Seder, and Maury's stepfather told her it was like Nathan Detroit's crap game, wherever the game was, it was Nathan's, wherever the Seder was, it would be hers.
Nice. So now all of this was triggered by how many words are different in this Mishnah question from our question. Shebechol halaylot. Ein, Anu, Matbilin, Afilin. So how many words?
Two
words. And those two words are opening up a whole world of historical development. And now, this is what I love about the fact that in my family we use a potato, which most people don't use. Because what does the karpas mean? If it's a potato, that karpas has within it the places we've been. Mm-hmm. Our family was someplace where it wasn't, when Pesach came around, the spring vegetables were not yet available. Okay? All right. Now, we're going to be on the lookout for other examples of what we can call ritualization. And if you think about ritualization is saying, take a potato, it's just a potato, and transform it into something of meaning. Okay? So that's something of religious meaning and sanctity. So it's about, now, let's go back to that question. All other nights, we really should have had a tip-off that there was a problem with our question. Why? Our version of the question. All other nights we do nothing. Mm-hmm. Tonight, twice that. Mm-hmm. You said all other nights we have chametz or matzah. Tonight,
just matzah.
All of the nights we don't dip at all. And tonight, we dip twice. So what's special about tonight?
Double dipping.
It's not double dipping. What's special about tonight is
we dip.
Dipping. So there's some problem in our version. The original version, all of the nights we have one. Tonight we have a second one. Okay. On that note.
So where did that translation come from? Which is
okay, so now
incorrect.
No, it is not. Why do you say it's incorrect?
Well, because it
it's not in the Mishnah.
It's a omission that you just talked about.
Okay. So we'll have a little break. We can pick up on that question.